I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. He first predicted the rise of the creative class. Now he says where you live is the most important decision you'll ever make. Richard Florida is our guest today in an extended conversation about how cities win, how they lose, and how that affects us all. We'll also talk with Meg Cheever. Meg is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. The Conservancy is hosting a major conference in September called Body and Soul, Parks and the Health of Great Cities. Plus the latest news from Plant Edison and our City Views commentator Walker Smith coming up today on Smart City. Right after this news. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Richard Florida is a best-selling author, an academic, and a lover of cities. He is professor of business and creativity at the Rotman School of Management at the University of Toronto. He's also head of the Prosperity Institute. His latest book is Who's Your City? Richard, let me ask you, I want you to analyze your own success. Why did the concept of the creative class turn into such a phenomenon?
Well, you know, I'm not sure. And as you know, Carol, it took me a long time to come up with that name. For a long time, I was going to title what became Rise of the Creative Class, Get Real, What's Really New About the Economy, the idea being that these social and cultural shifts were the big one. And then my editor in New York said, you know, Richard, you've identified this new class called the creative class. And I think he saw something that I didn't. You know, he was looking at the charts, the historical charts, the regional graphs, the maps. And after 9/11, I kind of relented because the subtitle of the book was then The Rise of the Creative Class and How It's Transforming Life, Community, and all the rest. And I think the construct just resonated with people in a way that I didn't quite fully understand. I remember people when the book became popular coming up to me and saying, I read the book and identified with it, or I read the book and I started telling my friends about it or my kids about it, or I sent one to the mayor. And as an academic, I had never had that experience. I'm not trained as a journalist. I'm not a writer of narrative nonfiction. So I think that people just resonated with something in that construct, and they were looking. They felt that they were part of a different group. Maybe they felt as if they were an outsider group. But I think it just took hold with people. And the rest of it, I guess if I really had to put my finger on it, you'd be, as an outsider and someone who's known me from well before and gave me some of my first speaking engagements, you'd be better equipped to understand this than I would. But I think I developed as a speaker, better as a speaker than as a writer. So what happened is I think the more I went out and I talked about the book in front of audiences, I could make the point better than I could in my writing. So I think my ability, I was single at the time, I had few family commitments. I think my ability to go on the road and talk about the book in front of audiences of people. But moreover, I think that people were looking for this, and this concept just came at the right time, and it gave people something to identify with that I had no idea. I mean, if you had asked me, I had no idea that they would. And it's been fun. I mean, it's been a great fun, and I think I've learned more from this than just about anything else I've ever done in my life.
You know, I can't imagine anyone not wanting to be in the creative class, right? I mean, that sounds like a good class to be in. It seems to me the term is often misunderstood, and certainly the path to getting there seems misunderstood. Do you find that to be true?
Yeah, but I think it's less poorly understood outside of America. Americans have a tough time with this word class, and I don't know why that is. It's just clear that it is. And I think also, to be quite candid, I mean, in the book I say quite clearly, every single human being is creative. The real task in society is to expand the boundaries of the creative class, to enable more people to join, to really harness the creativity of people who work in manufacturing or in service industries. But I also think there are enough, whether we call them neoconservatives or squelchers or anti-urbanists, the United States seems to have this machine for framing issues, and not just in political campaigns like Obama versus McCain. I think there was a group of people or a set of arguments that tried to really frame the word creative class in a way that made it sound elitist. And, you know, I didn't realize that quite at first. But, you know, when you see the same names coming up over and over again, creating a straw man argument, you know, equating the creative class with yuppies, sophistos, trendoids, and gays, trying to position the argument in a way that the author in this case didn't intend, I think there is a great effort at framing constructs. And, you know, if a construct has some sort of legs and seems to be appealing and seems to be democratizing or somehow pushing in a positive direction, I think there is some effort made to frame and reframe that concept. And then, so what do I have to do? Then I have to constantly clarify what I've meant. I think this is the great challenge of being a public intellectual, and it's what you're not prepared for in academic life. Academics are taught to do empirical studies, to report the results, to be scientific and positive, not normative. And I think once you become a public intellectual, things become much more normative, and they're framed in a much more challenging way by critics and opponents. So for me, that has also been my second great growth experience. And for any young academic listening in out there, Daniel Patrick Moynihan said this a long, long time ago in a book I read as a teenager. That's how geeky I was. He wrote a book called Maximum Feasible Misunderstanding, talking about his experiences as an academic at Harvard and then in the War on Poverty, initially under Lyndon Johnson and then in the Nixon administration. He said, one of the really kind of tragic things about having academics involved in government is that with any new idea, you're going to get maximum feasible misunderstanding. And I always look back at that book and thinking about my own work. And he said, you don't really want to blame academics for this, and you don't really want to blame politicians for this. They have different norms and motivations and incentives. But when you inject an academic idea or a new idea into a political process, you're going to get a lot of misunderstanding as just a result of how that process works.
You, more benignly than the class issue, it seems to me, is the tendency to want to frame the creative class or define the creative class only by youth. And that seems to me to be a common misunderstanding. You know the work we've done on Young and Restless, which is about youth, 25 to 34-year-olds. But creative class, of course, is far broader and has no age limits.
Well, I think there's a couple ways that the creative class is framed in the popular debate. One is as just artists. And on both sides, people with a pro-arts agenda and an anti-arts agenda. I think the other way is somehow yuppification. It's a bunch of kind of yuppies. And I think that's the way folks on the right, if you will, and the socially conservative right, including gays. And then I think as an age argument, and, you know, I'm of two minds on that one. One, the creative class construct is ageless, and we have no age identifiers in the work. It's all about occupations. And I think that's a really important point that not just myself, but people like Ann Markison and others, and we debate one another on how to define occupations and who to put in what occupations in what category. But I think the use of occupations is what I intended. But on youth, I'm of two minds. One is that, as I said, the creative class doesn't include an age identifier, so it doesn't have an age dimension. But what I do think is important is that young people in their early 20s, as your work with Joe Courtwright so clearly points out, and I cite it all the time, they're the people most likely to be making moving decisions, career, and in addition to that, career and job decisions and household formation decisions. Am I going to get married? How am I going to partner? So I think that they have to have a unique look because they're making a moving decision after college. They're making a job and career decision. They're making a family decision. They're almost, I look at them as fruit flies. No, they aren't the whole answer. But by looking at the behaviors of young people, particularly with regards to mobility, but also with regards to family formation and career choices, you get a very good lens, a biased lens, but a very useful lens into looking at patterns that may shape society in the future. So while the creative class doesn't have an age construct in it, I do think that looking at younger cohorts can shed important light, particularly on location decisions.
If you're just joining us, we're speaking with Dr. Richard Florida, who is author of the new book, Who's Your City? Richard, the thing that always makes me most nervous about the implications of your work, not your work. Of course, it's very solid, but the implications of your work, particularly when you think about the spiky cities and your newest book, your latest work, Hoosier City. And you go to great pains in Hoosier City, and I appreciate it that, you know, there are different strokes for different folks, different cities for different people. But when you really get down to it, I mean, it's, I think, a fair interpretation of your work is that some cities are in a favored position to attract smart people, and those are the cities that already have smart people because there's that positive reinforcing effect there. And there are cities that are in a not-so-favored position. Tell me I'm wrong.
I'm not going to say you're wrong. Most economists who work in this area, people like Ed Glaser at Harvard, would say that human capital accumulation, the ability to attract talent, is endogenous. They would say that if you start with a high level and have a couple of great universities, you have extraordinary advantage. So it makes perfect sense to them why the Bay Area or Greater Boston or even Chicago and others compete very well. They tend to see, most economists who work on this, tend to see human capital as a stock. I take a very different view that this is a flow. Talent is a flow. You would not see the growth of new talent-based areas if it wasn't a flow. And Ed Glaser himself shows that human capital levels across cities have diverged greatly since the 1970s. Pittsburgh has gone down. San Francisco and Washington, D.C. have gone up quite appreciably. So I think looking at a flow and looking at what are those characteristics of places, but to be quite blunt about this, in Hoosier City, I made the argument, and we did this with a great young fellow named Tim Goulden, who's a researcher at the University of Maryland. I mean, we actually wanted to do for the first time is really figure out how economically concentrated the world is. And so we used those great maps of the world at night, the satellite imageries, to really distill economic activity from the light emitted in those places. And what we found is that the world is incredibly concentrated in ways that few of us understand. And this mythology that the world is somehow flattening or leveling and we can all participate and plug in from wherever we are, it's just false. So what I said in the book is if we're going to understand the world we live in, we had better understand that there are about two dozen mega regions that really drive the world economy. About a dozen of those in North America, and about a dozen of those around the rest of the world. And moreover, I would say, is that most of the rest of the world is spikier than the United States. And one way to read the United States urban structure is that we were a very powerful, hegemonic, dominant nation who could afford to have a lot of interesting places. But if you look at a place like China or Russia or Mexico or even much of Europe, they are quite a bit spikier, to turn that phrase, than we are. So I worry. I think we have to be realistic. We have to understand what it's going to take to make great places, especially if places are not starting with those kind of advantages. I actually think the world is likely to get much spikier and the gains to size are likely to increase. So I think we have to understand that to make better public policy in the area rather than just kind of wish it away.
And what should the policy look like that would take into account that these spikes are going to get higher and lower, and what's to be done about mid-sized cities and those that don't start with the stock of human capital?
What I tried to say in Hoosier City is that you owe it to yourself as a person to take this decision of where to locate seriously. I say there are three big decisions in your life: the what you do, the who you partner with, and the where you live. And very few people have talked about where to live. And since writing the book, I've gotten lots of emails from very good friends who are very well versed in urbanism telling me about all the locational mistakes they've made. I've certainly made them in my own life. So I tried to say to people that understand this, and going back to your previous point, you know, being in New York City or London may be great for some people who want to work in finance or at the cutting edge of design or creative industries. But they're very congested places. They have a fast pace of life, and they might not be a great fit for everyone. So I think the point that the book is trying to make is you can make a choice trading off economic opportunity, lifestyle, quality of life, amenities, personality, happiness factors, and you have to make the choice that best fits you. I think from a public policy point of view, we had better figure out how we're going to cope with an increasingly not just economically and socially unequal world, a rising gap between rich and poor, the super rich and the rest of us, and all the things people talk about in political discourse. We're really talking about a geographic representation of that. And as the Chinese student said to me, who I quote in the book, he said, "Richard, if you think this issue is big in the United States," he said, "I come from Shanghai. And in Shanghai, even though I'm just in my middle 20s, I live better than you. I mean, I have a better lifestyle as a young consultant than you do or your peers do in academia." He said, "But the people at the outskirts of Shanghai live in pre-civilized conditions." And one of the things the book talks about is that if we don't address the spikiness, you know, by helping second and third tier cities cope, the political ramifications of this might be something we don't like. And I say, you know, what we don't want to do is end up making the world less spiky by chopping down the peaks. We want to make sure that the valleys have enough and are successful enough that they become legitimate and kind of reasonable and exciting places. I also think that would take the pressure off the housing prices, but I think it's a big, big issue for public policy. And I don't think it's something that mayors alone can address. I think mayors have done, you know, I say this in the book, mayors are the people who get it in the political realm. But I think it's something that at the national level, at the global level, we're going to have to start to address.
Do you think that it is about coping, or do you think there are actually strategies that help the valleys begin to spike?
Well, if you look at the history of capitalism, of economic development, one thing becomes incredibly clear. Time and space have been used much more intensively with each epoch of capitalism. So you had first had hunter-gatherer communities, then you had agricultural towns, then you had these kind of beginnings of mercantile cities, then you had the metropolitan area of cities and suburbs that we grew up in. Now you have this thing which I call and others call the mega region, which is this intensive use of time and space across metropolitan areas. This thing is just growing by leaps and bounds. And it's not a city to suburb, suburb to city, or the people moving back is the gentry. It's all part of the intensification of the use of space within and among these mega regions. I think for second and third tier regions that are outside of mega regions, it is a very difficult road. And it's got to go beyond coping because they've got to figure out a way to connect to these very intensive, spiky, incredibly concentrated centers of economic activity. Let's take an example of one that would be a very good one. Stockholm or Copenhagen, outside of our own country, wonderful cities, often atop the best places to live in the world, but outside of mega regions. For Stockholm or Copenhagen to compete, they have to do everything much better than London or New York or Chicago or even Toronto might. They have to have much higher levels of human capital. They have to nurture and develop talent across the board. They have to offer extraordinarily high quality of life. And I think that's something U.S. cities have to learn from, that if you're a second or third tier city, it is not enough just to cope and offer up yourself as maybe a low-cost destination, that you really have a tough competition. And I think the smaller Scandinavian cities get this because they've been isolated in a way, locationally isolated for so long. And they understand that if they're going to compete at a world scale, they really have to up the ante. I think North American cities are fantastic, and we have such a wide range. Many of them are doing great, but many of them are not coping effectively and are kind of just running along at half steam. And I think the ante has to be up. You know, we're in a world economy now, and every city is competing against global competitors. Whether we like it or not, you know, markets work and the ante is up. So North American cities have to come up to the test.
Richard, you say you've lived in how many cities?
Well, I say I've made 17 moves since I graduated college. I've not actually enumerated, but let's do it right now. I grew up in the Newark, New Jersey area. I won't talk about specific cities within that, but Newark, New Jersey. I went to college at Rutgers. Then I moved to New York, so we'll count that as two. I went to graduate school at Boston. We'll count that as three. Moved back to New York. That doesn't count. Moved off to Buffalo as a visiting professor. That's four. Then I went to Columbus as a professor. That's five. To Pittsburgh, that's six. Back to Boston, that can't count because I lived there already. To Washington, D.C., that's seven. And now to Toronto. So 17 moves amongst eight places, more or less, which is not atypical for an academic career, by the way. Academics tend to be highly mobile. And, you know, Herb Simon, my colleague at Carnegie Mellon, had a word. He said the way most of us make decisions is we don't optimize. He won the Nobel Prize for this. He said we satisfice. We kind of make an incrementally okay decision. And, you know, for me, I just moved to places where I thought jobs were good and academic opportunity was good. And I never really thought that much about the quality of this city I lived in until very, very recently. And, you know, to be quite frank, and I say this in the book, it's not about choosing quality of city over other things. Mark Fisher, kind of a good friend of mine, chastised me in the Washington Post. He said, well, Florida wrote this book called Who's Your City, saying you should pick the city that best fits you. And then he moved because he got this great institute opportunity in Toronto. And I said, well, Mark, you're absolutely right. I wrote him a note and said, you're absolutely right. That's the whole point. We have to look at the community we live in that trades off against or that optimizes, if you will, our career, our job, our lifestyle, and the qualities we love in a city. It's not an either-or decision. So only recently have I become much more aware of what I look for, and that's, I think, partly why I wrote Who's Your City, to help other people at least provide a heuristic or a framework for them to think through that same issue.
We'll be back with more conversation with Richard Florida in just a minute, but first, the latest news in the world of urban planning and design comes to us from Nate Berg of Plan Edison.
As the Summer Olympics wind down in Beijing, local business owners are expressing disappointment over what they see as a missed economic opportunity. The city has estimated that more than 2 million tourists would come to town for the games, but early figures put the actual number at just 600,000. According to a recent article in the Christian Science Monitor, local business people have been fuming over China's foreign visa policies, which they say have kept many people out of the country. These strict policies have even caused Chinese citizens not from Beijing to leave the city during the event. Hotel operators are especially miffed, as the expected boon of the Olympics inspired construction of more than 300 additional hotels since 2001. But with fewer visitors than expected, many of the city's hotel rooms sit empty, though many local business people are already complaining about the lackluster economic effects of the Olympics. Government tourism officials don't plan to release any figures until after the games are over. Temporary traffic bans and control measures are another way the Chinese government is attempting to manipulate Beijing during the Olympics. Reuters reports that the city government had instituted a 3-month limitation on cars driving in the city in an effort to improve its notoriously poor air quality during the games. Depending on a car's license plate number, it is banned from driving in the city on alternate days between July 20th and September 20th. And though the move has made driving in the city safer and played a role in slightly improving air quality, officials say the temporary ban will end as scheduled. And though the government is hoping the ban will result in an increase in the number of people using public transit, the actual totals are expected to drop off when the car ban is lifted September 20th. Meanwhile, cities across the planet are experimenting with their own car bans. Following the lead of Bogota, Colombia's weekly temporary street closures known as Ciclovia, cities like New York, London, San Francisco, and Paris are all instituting their own temporary car bans. Portland, Oregon closed a large section of streets in June, bringing thousands of pedestrians, bikers, and strollers out to the event. San Francisco plans to close a 6-mile section of road at the end of August, and New York has scheduled 3 Saturdays of street closures. Advocates for public spaces are applauding these efforts by cities, saying the simple events do more than just bring people out onto the street for a few hours, but actually change their perception of what a street is for and what it means to live in a lively city. And in Seattle, residents are looking to take back control of their streets, not with feel-good day-long events, but with speed bumps. The Seattle Times reports that residents in the city's New Holly neighborhood became so concerned about drivers speeding through their streets, they teamed up to get the city to install some traffic-calming measures. The city refused their requests, citing studies that show average speeds below the thresholds for installing speed bumps. So neighbors pooled funds, took the law into their own hands, and bought 8 rubberized speed bumps online for $900 and installed them on their streets. 6 weeks later, the city came in and removed them, much to the dismay of the citizens. The city claims that more street signs are being purchased for the neighborhood and that a traffic circle is being planned for one of the neighborhood's busiest intersections. Work that is expected to cost about $15,000. Though residents are happy the city is planning to do something, they say their traffic is a $15,000 problem they'd already solved with $900 worth of speed bumps. For PlanEdison, I'm Nate Berg.
Nate Berg is the assistant editor of PlanEdison.com. When we come back, we'll have more of our conversation with Richard Florida about his new book, Who's Your City? You're listening to Smart City, and I'm Carol Coletta. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Richard Florida is the author of the book, Who's Your City? In it, he makes the case that where you live is the most important decision you'll ever make. Before the break, Richard was talking about the cities he's lived in and his reasons for moving there. In an increasingly mobile world, and you're certainly an example of that, what do you think urban leaders can do to attach you to place and to attach their citizens, their mobile citizens to place and call it home in a way that would encourage them to invest their time, their talent, their money, and their legacy?
Well, you know, these are the things that keep me up at night. I don't think it's possible. I think we have a much more highly mobile population than anyone wants to admit. And in the book, I talk about three kinds of people: the mobile, the rooted, those of us who could be mobile and choose to stay in a place, and the stuck, those who can't move. Highly skilled people across fields, whether that's finance or arts, music, science, academia, highly skilled, highly talented people are incredibly mobile. And they move not only across state and city borders, they move across national borders. I just think of my colleagues in the academic world. So I think what we have on our hands is a situation in these creative or intangible industries where people are no longer stuck having to work where there's fertile soil or raw material or even large capital-intensive factories. We're talking about places for whom advantage is constructed. It has to do with human capital accumulation, but it can be very fleeting. And you have to understand that large fractions of your population, especially your talented population, are likely to move. So I've always said that. The key is not just generating talent. The key is not just retaining talent. The key has to be to attract people. And I think there's two or three ways places can attract people. One is obvious. You have to have an abundance of great and interesting economic opportunity. Two, you have to be, and I talk about this in the book, a safe and secure and reasonably high quality of life place to live. But three, I think most people these days are moving mainly for the reason that they want to express themselves through their career, through their jobs, through their lifestyle. The one thing that places can really do is become the kind of place that people feel comfortable expressing themselves. And I think one of the reasons Chicago has solidified its position among so many other Midwestern cities is that it almost is the one Midwestern city, and I think Minneapolis shares this as well, if you call it a Midwestern city, where people can self-express. I certainly think the Toronto shift from kind of a stodgy, old-school kind of Anglo town to a dynamic, thriving metropolis attracting immigrants like crazy and building creative industries, entertainment industries, a better finance industry has lots to do with its role in being a place where people can self-express. But I do think it's going to be harder and harder for places to hold on to people. And I love Anna Lee Saxenian, my colleague at the University of California at Berkeley. She says it's no longer about, you know, brain drain. It's really about brain circulation. And if you can make your place a node, she's talking about countries, but if you can make your place a node in brain circulation, you know, if Chicago is a node or Toronto is a node or San Francisco or Hong Kong or London, that's what's really key. That's what places really need to do, not try to tack people's feet to the floor, but make it an attractive place for them to want to be. And if they want to leave, say that's fine, but, you know, maintain some kind of attachment, talk well of the place. And certainly don't push people out the door when they're going to leave, you know. Make sure that they're going to continue to function as ambassadors for your place.
What is it that interests you now, Richard? What's next? What don't you know that you'd like to know?
The Institute here, the Prosperity Institute at the University of Toronto, is an attempt to really mass research capability. So, I mean, the government and the private sector have put $100 million into this institute. We have a reasonable we're building a building, but we have a reasonable stream of research funding, and we're amassing talent both in Toronto and around the world. Obviously, I think I really want to understand what geographers would call, big word folks, the new spatial fix. I think that, you know, there was the rise of the industrial city. Then there was the rise of suburbanization a la Fordism and the suburban metropolitan area of the 1950s, 60s, 70s. I think just like that industrial age has broken down, we're emerging on not only a new creative knowledge-driven economy, but we have a new geography. And that geography is captured in the rise of these mega regions that are composed of cities and suburbs. They're no longer monocentric with just a downtown. They're polycentric. They have edge cities. I think trying to understand what this new spatial fix is, and I think one of the things we're going to try to do is really map out the future of the mega region and the mega city, not just with social scientists. We've amassed an amazing group of civil engineers here who, in their words, are working on the skeleton of the mega region and the mega city, the skeleton being its infrastructure. And in my work, I've worked on social, demographic, economic, technological issues. I think understanding that skeleton, because, you know, the skeleton we put into the Fordist age, which was highways and autos, actually had a lot to do not only with our consumption, but our jobs. So understanding the skeleton we put in place and all the things we grow off it is important. The second thing I want to work on is psychogeography. And I touch on that in Hoosier City. There's been very, very little work on the psychology of places. And it's fairly clear to me from the work we've been doing with Jason Renfro at Cambridge University, a young psychologist, is that the psychology of places is very different. You know, I had talked about places that attract gays and bohemians. That's all well and good. I think another way of looking at it is places that have been either able to attract or generate open to experience people, people who are likely to be very creative, innovative, musically, technologically, understanding the geography of personality. And then thirdly, there's just my great love. And now I'm at a point in my career where I can do it. I'm really begun to work very seriously on music and the role, not only the geography of music and of music scenes, but on what music means to our economy and our society. And just in a nutshell, I think that when you look at the lens of economy and society and you look at the role of music, music has played an extraordinary role in technological innovation, from the phonograph to the radio to the iPod to the video game. It's played an extraordinary role in consumption, in helping us figure out the things we want to buy or help us sell things. But I think also looking at music and at musicians, it's almost like a fruit fly industry. If you really want to understand innovative, creative, intangible, knowledge-driven industries, by looking closely at the location patterns of musicians, at musical careers, and I'll give you one example that might just sound terribly boring, but folks, bear with me. We're having a conversation at the Institute about what makes a success in high-tech startups the other day, and the notion that I've known since writing my earliest work on venture capital, that it's only partly about the technological idea. It's a ton about management and execution and how venture capitalists are always looking at the team. And I drew out a hypothesis. I said, might it be the case that successful rock and roll bands are not necessarily only the ones with the best sound, but that the bands that are successful in a Darwinian sense are the ones that somehow find a way to be well-managed and well-organized? And somebody made a joke about the Doors, and they said, well, you know, Robbie Krieger's father managed that band. And somebody said, well, the Beatles, it was Brian Epstein. So actually understanding the pathways to success in music, the role of creativity qua creativity, but the role of management and execution. And what's so cool about music is that there's been, until very recently, the research that's been done has tended to be on classical music, a little bit on popular music. So it's a wide open field. So those are the things we'll be working on. And I'm just having a blast. I'm having more fun than I could ever imagine.
Well, we always look forward to what's next from you, Richard. Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
Oh, Carol, thanks for having me on.
Richard Florida's latest book is called Hoosier City. Meg Cheever is our next guest. Meg is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy, an organization dedicated to restoring the Pittsburgh park system to excellence. Pittsburgh is hosting the 2008 International Urban Parks Conference titled Body and Soul, Parks and the Health of Great Cities. Meg, why have parks become such a hot issue for cities?
Parks have become a really hot issue for cities because they're so important to economic development and to quality of life, which are obviously related to each other. But I think what we've found in Pittsburgh is that people really want to come and live, work, and play in a city that has a wonderful park system.
But just a few years ago, parks had really become an afterthought in cities. It was very hard to get any money for parks. I mean, they were way down the list after all the other things that cities need to take care of. So why now? Why has the importance of parks been rediscovered?
you're talking about two separate issues, Carol. I think the importance of parks has been rediscovered because people love to use them. But I'm not sure it's any easier now than it was 10 or 20 years ago to get city funding for parks. At least in our city, the budget is really strapped, and there's always the primary need for police and fire, public safety. What you see is the rise of groups like our Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy and the Central Park Conservancy in New York, the Prospect Park Alliance, which are private, nonprofit park support groups that have sprung up to partner with city government and the community to raise the additional money that's needed to both restore older historic parks in cities and then help keep them lively. So I think it's a combination of not all that much more money from government, but a lot more private fundraising and really a resurgence of interest in the parks.
You recently raised $30 million for Pittsburgh's parks.
We recently raised $40 million for Pittsburgh parks, although it's a 12-year total, so I don't know if you'd call it recent, but fairly recent. I think, again, that was really because people realized that the wonderful parks we have here in the city of Pittsburgh have been in place for over 100 years and have a century or more of memories of all Pittsburghers within them, and they just weren't being taken care of the way that we all wanted them to be due to lack of funds.
And was that your pitch? These parks aren't going to get taken care of if we don't take care of them?
I think that was pretty apparent because our city was struggling on how to have a balanced budget and take care of all its needs. Although I think there are some really dedicated and wonderful public servants working on the parks within the city, they just didn't have the financial resources they needed to do all the things that needed to be done.
Let me ask you something, Meg. If there is public support for parks, why don't we simply fund them out of the joint fundraising we do call taxes? We don't go out and raise private dollars for police. We don't do it for fire. We don't do it for street maintenance. Why do you think we have to do it for parks?
Because I think for a long time, parks were viewed, as you kind of suggested, as a frill sort of thing. And, you know, obviously public safety has to be the primary issue. So one wonderful thing that happened in the Pittsburgh region is that probably 15 years ago, a sales tax override was put in called the Allegheny Regional Asset District that created a pool of money that was for cultural assets, and the parks were included in that, as were the libraries and some other cultural assets. And that money is basically earmarked only for these assets. And that's really the way to collect some tax revenue properly for parks so that it's dedicated and can only be used on parks, because otherwise the temptation for elected officials is just too great to spend the money for public safety. Not that I'm not against public safety, but I think it's really nice to have just some small pot of money to go to parks.
And if you were making a case to the city, any city, for public funding of parks, make your best case.
Talented people can live almost anywhere in this age of the internet and electronic communications. So for a city to be its most competitive and have the best quality of life, a great system of beautiful, well taken care of, well programmed parks interconnected by a system of trails is really a wonderful competitive asset. And also, with worries about today's youth being sedentary, inside, and overweight, it's a wonderful opportunity to use these physical assets of cities to encourage children to go outside, connect with nature, and develop a bond with the natural world, and also exercise and be as healthy as they can be. So the theme and title of the International Urban Parks Conference that will be in Pittsburgh this September is Body and Soul, Parks and the Health of Great Cities.
Well, I was just about to ask you about the conference. Tell me who's gathering and what topics will be on the agenda.
Well, we're expecting somewhere between 300 and 500 park professionals from around the country and around the world. We already have registrations from over 25 states and I think about 6 foreign countries. And the agenda is just what we were discussing, which is to have people learn from each other, but basically concentrate on making the case for parks as really key assets in the overall livability of a city and the health of its population. And I think that we've all realized, those of us from everywhere who are working on parks, that we perhaps need to do a better job of making this case about what key assets parks are. And the emphasis on economic development and on the health of the population is really important. It's how to make the best case to government, and conveniently, it's true.
You know, we've seen the arts increasingly make their case as an economic development case. I mean, look at the economic impact of the arts. And it seems that you've just suggested that is certainly one case to be made for parks. And as you say, it's a legitimate case to be made for parks. But is there any role today in a pitch to either cities or to private investors that it's about beauty, it's about restoration, it's about renewal? You know, can you make that case credibly today, or do people just say, what are you talking about? It's got to be about money, or it's not about anything important.
Oh, no. I think that you're absolutely right, Carol. Parks are really important to the beauty of a city, and people care about experiencing that beauty and the beauty of the natural world. One of the sessions at our conference is entitled What Olmsted Knew, and Frederick Law Olmsted was a 19th century figure who was one of the designers of Central Park in New York, and really the father of American landscape architecture. And he had some wonderfully eloquent statements about how important it is for people to be able to retreat from the bustle of city life and find peace and beauty that they can appreciate in a natural setting. So I think what we're finding is that he was right then, and he's been right all along. That was borne out for me when we did a focus group a few years ago with some college students, and we were asking them how they felt about parks. And I remember in particular one young lady who looked to be about 18 said that she thought that parks were so important because they were places of spiritual refreshment. So to me, that meant that Olmsted was resonating, even if she wasn't referring to him specifically.
What do you expect to create the most buzz among your delegates? What's the topic that's going to get them talking?
Well, one of the things that I'm excited to show our delegates is a model project, I think, here in Pittsburgh, where a piece of Schenley Park land — Schenley is one of our flagship parks — had been part of the park for 100 years, but had over time, for the last 40 years or so, been made into a parking lot. And a few years ago, we, working with a large group of other institutions and community leaders, were able to get a plan in place and the funding to take this parking lot out and make it a public open space again with a large grass lawn. And one of the college kids who was using it the other day said that he thought that they had paved a parking lot and put up paradise. So I thought, with apologies to Joni Mitchell. So I thought that was pretty cute and is sort of unusual. So I'm really excited to be able to show that off. And as far as the sessions go, I think we have an amazing array of speakers, from Teresa Hines, who's going to give a very broad perspective, to an address by the Secretary of the Department of Conservation and Natural Resources for Pennsylvania, Mike DeBerardinas, who's going to talk about his role in the parks in Pennsylvania. And we've got Bruce Katz from Brookings, and Alex Garvin coming from New York, Luis Garden Acosta. The list goes on and on. We have some just really interesting thinkers and speakers about parks.
If you just tuned in, our guest is Meg Cheever. She is president and CEO of Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. Meg, you've run the conservancy for 11 years. What is your relationship now to the city of Pittsburgh?
I think we are very proud of the strong relationship we've had since the beginning, Carol, with the city leadership. And our mayor, Luke Ravenstahl, is a former member of city council, and one of our largest parks is in his district. So we're lucky to have worked with him for quite a long time. And our county executive was also on city council before becoming the county executive and has been on our board since that time. So we really try to work hand in glove with government and feel that that's one of the reasons that our partnership has been effective.
But what is the city's role in building, maintaining, and programming parks, and what is your role?
Well, that's very interesting. It's been evolving. I think that in the first 6 or 7 years of our partnership, we concentrated on capital projects and on trying to raise the money and help manage the capital projects to restore some of the land and buildings and infrastructure of our great city parks that had been let go over 50 years just due to lack of funding. We've completed about 8 major capital projects, and while we were doing that, the city was really doing the other 2 main park functions, park maintenance and visitor services and programs. We worked so closely together that we wound up developing a plan for woodland management and maintenance, and we are very active in that area and marshal a lot of volunteer help to assist. And then for this park that I was discussing that used to be a parking lot and is now a public space, it's very actively programmed and has food kiosks and lots of entertainment and 24/7 security and free wireless internet and extra sanitation. So we actually have a lease and management agreement of that space and one other space. So in some few areas, we are actually functioning almost as a little mini parks department within the city government, although we certainly do all of it in partnership with the city. And even in the case where we're managing, we have some help from the city parks crews.
Yeah, what's the rationalization for splitting those responsibilities? Why are you programming one park and essentially running that park on behalf of the city? How did you divide responsibilities?
Well, I think the funders had some input into that because it's probably a more complicated assignment than the typical one for a parks crew. So I think the funders expressed interest in having our intervention as having a contract to do this. But it's worked out very well, and we appreciate the funders' confidence and the city's support, and I think they appreciate us too.
Meg, thanks so much for being our guest on Smart City.
I'm so happy to have been asked. Thank you.
Meg Cheever is the executive director of the Pittsburgh Parks Conservancy. The 2008 International Urban Parks Conference will be September 21st through 23rd in Pittsburgh. Walker Smith got some disappointing news in his inbox this week, but instead of despairing, our City Views commentator looks to a new source for inspiration.
When the CNN update hit my email inbox with the news that former North Carolina Senator John Edwards had admitted to an extramarital affair that he had long denied, my first thoughts were about his wife and family, and then about the extraordinary faith, trust, and hope that we invest in our leaders, political and otherwise. We need them to be the best part of us. We rely upon them for the inspiration and motivation it takes for us to live up to the ideals we value most. When our leaders prove incapable of offering this example, our disappointment further deepens our cynicism over the jaded state of modern life. Ideals, it seems, are just a false promise, a political ruse that continues to work because we continue to be so gullible. I do not ascribe to the view that our leaders are human too, so we must overlook or look beyond their peccadilloes. Certainly we must, as with everyone, forgive them and hope for their well-being. But in taking on or aspiring to a leadership role, they have assumed duties and obligations that hold them to a higher standard. If you want to be a leader, then you must be so 100%. If you can't do that, if you can't live up to the demands and expectations of that responsibility, then don't ask for the job. This is no different than what we expect and require of others in other roles. Parents cannot abandon their children, nor husbands their wives. Drivers cannot drive recklessly or drunk. CEOs of public companies cannot hide financial risk, nor can insiders beat the market using privileged information. In other words, when you take on a role, you're expected to live up to it. Otherwise, don't do it. Simple as that. I also do not ascribe to the view that we shouldn't allow ourselves to be dependent on leaders, that it's up to each of us to make do for ourselves. Such a view ignores the fact that we are social creatures who depend upon one another and who have a deep, probably genetic need for the comforts and connections of community. We look to one another for guidance and direction, for help and aid, for inspiration and motivation. We want leaders. Indeed, we can't live without them. Perhaps we could make do without others or leaders, but the cynicism and despair that would push us there would surely kill the spirit that sparks and animates our lives. Alas, here we are again, with yet another betrayal by one who aspired to lead us. But I refuse to give in to cynicism. I will not allow the failures of one who cannot live up to his responsibilities cause me to lose hope that there is a leader who can bring us a vision and an example that will rally us to be the best we can. After all, there is one person I see in the midst of this scandal who reminds me that there are many people whose examples offer us hope. Look to your wife, Mr. Edwards, for there we find inspiration and no small measure of optimism about our future. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Want to learn more about Richard Florida's book and Meg Cheever's conference? Head over to our website, smartcityradio.com. We've got links to all our guest work, archives of our past shows, and a podcast so you can take Smart City with you wherever you go. Got a question? Send it to questions@smartcityradio.com, or while you're on our site, click on the contact link. Smart City's web content and audio archive are supported by CEOs for Cities, and national distribution is made possible by the Hyde Family Foundation's investing in programs that generate lasting change to improve the future of Memphis, Tennessee, and its citizens. For more information, visit HydeFoundations.org. Scotty Iseri is our producer and engineer. He just went downstairs to buy a milkshake, and I'm Carol Coletta.